Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, welcome back to Behind the Knife, and we are still on our global health series here, and we are lucky enough to have Dr. Ravello of Harvard here. He's the Director of Global Surgery Programs for the Center of Surgery and Public Health at Brigham and Women's. He's also an Assistant Professor of Surgery and Global Health at Harvard. Welcome, Dr. Ravello. We're excited to have you.
Thank you. It's I'm excited to be on and looking forward to our conversation.
If you could just take our listeners back here. A lot of us are surgery residents or med students, and we're kind of interested in this, but you're really full-fledged in the global health world. Can you tell us a little bit how you got to where you are right now and what brought your interest here?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think when I describe my career path, it's there are a number of contributing factors, like little streams leading into river. I think, so if I list those out, some of my family background. My parents are immigrants from Argentina. So while I grew up in the U.S., I grew up biculturally, and we traveled to South America every other year. Grew up in a bilingual home. And so it starts off with my parents, just giving me a broader worldview of more than one culture and more than one understanding of what life looks like. That was the first piece. I think the second piece came a bit from my schooling, actually. The second piece came from one of those trips to Argentina. I was probably 7, 8 years old. And as you drive out of Buenos Aires, the capital, which is this lovely Parisian city, at the time, Buenos Aires was ringed by shanty towns. And I remember driving this overpass and looking down and seeing people living in shacks and horse-drawn wagons taking trash out of the city. And I was bothered by it. I didn't know the word disparities or inequity at the time, but that sense of the world is unfair kind of came crashing in on me, at least my 8-year-old mind, in a way that obviously still sticks with me today. And I remember my mom registering that I was bothered by this, and we talked a bit about it later. I think a third piece remains my faith. I'm a Protestant Christian, and as I think about how to live life, pattern that after how Jesus lived his life, which was healing the sick and speaking out for justice and looking out for the poor, in addition to preaching, etc. And so medicine and global health fits that a lot. And so in that vein, when I was coming out of high school and into college, I thought maybe perhaps a career would be being a doctor and working through faith-based organizations in a rural missions faith-based hospital in Africa for the 10, 20, 30 year path that obscure biographies of old missionary surgeons in the kind of Albert Schweitzer-esque mode that I would read about. I think you put all those pieces together. And I think the last part was, this one's important. I failed to mention it. It goes back to high school as well. World history, as at least it was taught in Southern California in the 1980s, was really the history of ancient civilizations leading to mid-1900s Western civilization. And at the back of the book, there was a chapter on Asian history and a chapter on African history. One chapter for each of them, and we never read them. And that also bothered me. So in college, I took courses on the history of modern Africa and was moved. I was specifically moved at the time for no specific reasons, but by Angola's modern history from the time of tremendously bad Portuguese colonization, and through a really drawn out in an awful civil war post-independence. So my first long-term engagement as a surgeon in global health work was in Angola from a year after residency. But all those sort of streams ended up leading into wanted to do this kind of work. The academic piece came a little later. I was doing a master's of public health, and it was there that I recognized there was probably more than one way and more than one avenue to make an impact for poor people who either don't get surgical care, or if they do, it's poor quality, or if they do, it's way too late. And I recognized I was a teacher, and so the academic piece, at least as far as teaching and training, became more appealing and sort of seemed a good fit for me at the, up until this time.
Well, Dr. Raviola, it seems to me that you're very family oriented, and congratulations on your newest adoption. And one thing that is very curious to us and something we haven't heard from a lot of surgeons before is taking your whole family to live with you in these settings where you practice medicine. Can you tell us about maybe some of the challenges or, you know, the things you got to think about when you do this?
And kind of what your yearly schedule is. I hear you kind of alternate between the U.S. and Africa.
Yeah, I think I'll take the second question first because it's easier. So I've now been at the Brigham since finished fellowship in 2009, and I've been on staff since then. And initially we were in Boston 9 months out of the year, and in Africa, mostly Rwanda, for 3 months out of the year. And sometimes I was a solid 3 month block, and sometimes it was piecemeal. And then a few years later, through a program called the Human Resources for Health Program of Rwanda, that shifted to 6 and 6 months. And this year, the goal was to be there for 9 months, i.e. our older son's school calendar, doing schooling there, and then when he's on school leave, being back here in the States. So always a hybrid where we kind of have a foot in both worlds, hoping to leverage the resources and contacts from our U.S.-based institution for the benefit of the trainees and patients and institutions in our African institution, so in Rwanda, in this case, the University of Rwanda. Doing that with, and that's, to be honest, every year we sort of reassess what, where's our family, where each of our careers, my wife's also a physician, and I'll talk about that in a second, where are the programs on that side. And so it's not been static. There have not been 2 years that have been exactly the same. In terms of doing this with family, my wife and I have been talking about global health work since before we were married. In fact, it was almost a condition of getting married. I had long been moving this direction, and when we started dating for the second time, we met as freshmen in college and sort of reconnected years later when I was in med school. It was pretty clear to Beth, my wife, that this kind of work was something I was deeply drawn to, called to, and to use her own words, it wouldn't be fair to marry someone with that sort of sense of dedication, and then, after, you know, knowing that beforehand, and then getting married and saying, "Oh, sorry, I can't do it," and then taking their dreams from them. So she actually spent a few weeks in Kenya with the family of Kenyan friends, both in the capital and upcountry, and could kind of created a vision for how life could look for herself. My wife's also a physician. She's internal medicine, pulmonary critical care, and also works in the Harvard system. She's at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital. So I consider myself extremely fortunate, right? I have a partner for whom her career goals and interests align perfectly with mine. And we are both at institutions that have figured out, or at least provided us the flexibility to allow us to figure out how to do this. So we travel together. We try not to spend more than 2 weeks apart in any given time. We just find it's too hard to catch up relationally beyond 2 weeks. That's not true for all people in this space. I've had mentees and I've had hirees or recruits who've taken different tacks, and it's worked for them in their relationships. But for us, that's just our outer limit. Up until now, we were a one-child family, and our son travels with us. He's Rwandese-American, adopted in infancy. So he's been in school there, and he's been in school here. And I think that gives him a much broader worldview, and has made him more resilient. It's not all been super easy. We've had wonderful schools on both sides have been very flexible with this, but and our oldest son has done a great job of making friends on both sides. But even now we're sort of reconnoitering and saying, okay, well, for next year, with our new family configuration, what makes the most sense for the whole group, for each child, and for our careers? And I won't tell you now what that's going to be because I don't know yet. But it does require a lot of communication between us and kind of circling back to what are our goals, what are we about, what are our priorities, and our current activities aligning with those.
Could you just briefly tell us what your training track was? Because you said you did a fellowship. What was the training track that led you here?
Yeah. So all in the U.S., all the trainings in the U.S. So undergrad, I was a biology major at Harvard College. And I spent a year in the Philippines after that, kind of exploring. Am I going to go into healthcare and cross-cultural work? And the answers ended up being yes and yes. And that was really, you know, post-college kid with no practical skills and working with a Christian NGO development organization in the slums of Manila, living with urban squatters. So from there, I went to med school in San Diego, UCSD. And between my third and fourth year of med school, I came to Boston for a year to do a Master's of Public Health, the Harvard School of Public Health. And that's, for me, was a turning point. I was a fairly uninspired and uninspiring medical student my first 3 years, to be frank. And I that's where I sort of, as I mentioned earlier, got a picture of there's more than one way to be engaged in this work. There are humanitarians who are working with Doctors Without Borders, the ICRC, et cetera. And I think you'll be interviewing some of those folks in one of the other podcasts. There are the long-term faith-based organization folks. There are academics. There are people working at the super high policy levels, WHO, et cetera. And I think you're also talking with John Mira. And so you'll get a picture of what that could look like. And for me, that school public health year opened my eyes to, there's really a lot of different ways that one can make an impact. And I finished med school. At the same time, my wife and I got married. And then to Nashville for general surgery residency at Vanderbilt University. There, as like for a lot of our listeners, it's a critical time of maturation, not only in career, but in life. And the program director of Vanderbilt at the time and up until this past year, was a man named John Tarpley, who is both a mentor and like a second dad to me. A lot of us there think of him as an elder statesman to academic global surgery. I finished there in 2006 and spent my first year out in Angola in a small missions hospital that had, by no design of ours, opened its doors a week and a half after we got there. My wife arrived just out of med school, and with the two of us, we doubled the number of doctors at the place. The hospital director was an old-time missionary surgeon from Canada named Steve Foster, who'd been in Angola for most of its 27-year-long civil war, and was just truly a general surgeon's general surgeon. He does VP shunts and radical hysterectomies and all kinds of orthopedics work and hip replacements, as well as laparotomies and skin and soft tissue. So just a phenomenal guy to work under. And then finally, back to Boston, to Brigham, where I did trauma, acute care surgery, burn care, and critical care. There I was really the trailing spouse. My wife was the one being recruited into her internal medicine residency, and I kind of came in on her coattails and stayed at Brigham.
I think now we really want to jump back into your time specifically in these global areas, such as, you know, talking about you doubled the physicians at the most recent place you went. You know, what is it like, you know, building relationships with surgeons from other cultures and those in the lower income countries? Is it, what's, you know, what are the difficulties? Is there good things you can learn from them as well? Or
it's a great question. And I'm sure there are as many answers to that question as there are combinations of surgeons who have befriended surgeons from different cultures who have befriended each other. That said, I think there's a lot to be said for developing professional connections, which can ultimately over time turn into friendships across cultures and across contexts. There's something fascinating. I mean, surgeons are surgeons. I think it was Atul Gawande who once pointed out that he's never met a surgeon in any country who didn't complain about turnover time and didn't think that the anesthesiologists were hurting their patients and didn't complain about X, Y, and Z. So there's some universals that almost to the T go everywhere, anywhere you go, which is a bit tongue-in-cheek, but there's some truth to that, and it sort of creates at least a superficial place for bonding. I think there are other obvious common grounds, right? At the beginning of it all, we all started these fields in some measure because we wanted to take care of people, and we loved the pragmatism of surgery, and we loved the sense that you can make a radical difference in someone's life in a short period of time using your hands, which is right. It's the magic, and that I think that is a common bond that is easy to link to. Working in other contexts is tough. I often kind of put it in three, what the difference is, in three large buckets. If you're coming from a U.S. context, going to a low-income setting or a less resourced setting, I think the first is the epidemiology. If you're in epidemiology, it's not that there's rich country epidemiology and poor country epidemiology. There's local epidemiology. So in Rwanda, we see, like in a lot of belt across Africa, we see a lot of perforated ileum from typhoid, and we see a lot of sigmoid volvulus, and we never see sigmoid diverticulitis. So those are just different. And some of that is tropical medicine, and some of that is nutrition, etc. And then there's diseases of poverty, or the presentation of disease as caused by poverty. So the vast majority of the gastric cancers, and there's a ton of gastric cancer in our region, presents with gastric outlet obstruction and are non-operable, and we're doing palliative surgery, or very advanced rectal cancers. And so maybe you're also only managing to divert and palliate, which is very different than coming from a setting where there are screening programs and endoscopy is easy to access, and you do cancer surgery primarily and almost always for cure, with intention to cure. Diseases of poverty include advanced TB, that TB can turn an abscess anywhere. So there's epidemiology that's different. I went a little long on that. Scope of practice becomes different as well, and it's this makes for a great set of ethical discussions. And I think if we're too simplistic about it, then on either side of this, the debate of whether you should operate as a foreign surgeon in a new context, if you should operate beyond the scope of practice you would have in your home setting, I think there are very simple responses to that, and they're probably all wrong. But my scope of practice in Rwanda is broader than it is at Brigham and Women's Hospital. A couple years ago, I was a pediatric surgeon for the University Teaching Hospital, not because I had fellowship training in it, but because nobody else did either, but kids still needed operations. I do a lot of cancer work in Rwanda, but as an acute care surgeon in the States, I only do cancer if it's bleeding, perforated, obstructing, or ischemic, right? But not for cure. So scope of practice, you have to deal with how much can you learn outside of what you were trained in, and how can you do it safely, not harming patients, but also not neglecting patients who need care. I think the third big difference is the whole resource package. That's the stuff. You don't have all the tools and technology, or the instruments are not new and the needle drivers are the wrong size, or the tips don't actually hold the needles anymore, so you have to load your needle far back. There's the staff. You know, there are just not enough anesthetists and very few nurses around the theater. There's a space. You know, do you have enough ORs? Is your OR big enough? Is the OR a place you're comfortable in? And there's systems. Is your blood banking working? Is your electricity at the moment? Does somebody have an iPhone that they can light up the field if you forgot to wear your headlight? So that sort of the learning to work in a resource, as one of my fellows has now coined it, a resource variable environment, is one of the big differences. So you asked about engaging with other surgeons. I think dealing with the first of those three boxes mostly requires patience and grace and a lot of humility and ability to laugh at yourself and ask for help whenever you can find it. And if you can go somewhere new with patience, grace, humility, and the ability to ask for help, I think that gets you really far with folks. Don't assume you know what the problems are. You definitely don't know what the answers are. I'm going to stop with this quote. John Tarpley, my mentor that I mentioned, who worked for 12 out of 15 years full-time in Nigeria, and then the next 20-some years as Vanderbilt program director, went back to Nigeria every year for visits and connecting and bringing specialists. About 10 years ago, I went to Nigeria with him, and somewhere along the way there, he said, you know, after 30-plus years of being connected to Nigeria, I'm not even sure I know what the questions are, much less the answers. And I think what he was getting at was, don't assume you know too much. Go with humility. Ask questions. Ask local folks what are the issues. And maybe together you can help approach some of those answers.
Wow. That brought up a whole another load of questions I have. But the one thing I wanted to get to was, I know you help run the human resources for health programs. And it's a program, the little I understand, is that to train Rwandan physicians alongside U.S. physicians. I was wondering if you could tell us a little about that and also highlight areas that the U.S. expertise helps and area like and just sort of your role and how perceptive they are to that.
Sure. Thank you for that. I think it's a great program to highlight. So the Rwanda Human Resources for Health Program is it's a grant-based program. It's a seven-year-long program of the Ministry of Health of Rwanda that's funded by a U.S. federal grant through USAID, through the CDC, some through PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And it's the big goals of the program is to increase both the numbers and the qualities of four large cadres of health providers. So doctors, nurses, health managers, and dentists. And the way that program is implemented is through a partnership between the Ministry of Health of Rwanda and the University of Rwanda with a consortium of about 20 academic medical centers in U.S. academic institutions that provide teaching faculty in those cadres, so doctors, nurses, health managers, and dentists, and for the doctors, the various specialties, so surgeons, anesthesiologists, internists, pediatricians, obstetricians, pathologists, radiologists, psychiatrists. I probably missed something along the way, but ENT. And those faculty who are paid by the grant, or our salaries are sort of backfilled to the grant, if you will, live in Rwanda and integrate into the University of Rwanda teaching faculty with our individual goals, both to, as a surgeon in that setting, actually my job description there is not that dissimilar to my job description at Brigham. I train residents, teach medical students, and I work with faculty, Rwandan faculty, to strengthen their departments for teaching. So either writing, building, or strengthening their curriculum, implementing morbidity mortality meetings, strengthening their teaching programs, etc. And so we're now the iChurch program is now in its fourth year of 7 years, with the goal that at the end of this time, the initial projections were that Rwanda had roughly 600 doctors and only 150 of them had any specialty training, meaning the other 450 had finished medical school and that was it. So the goals in physicians was to double the number of doctors, nearly 1,200 by the end of the time, and to double the proportion that are specially trained, i.e. of those 1,200, half of them being specially trained in all the various specialties. And similar goals in nursing, in dentistry and health management is actually to start those training programs. They were not in existence before. So the faculty recruitment is now in a tapering mode. So in the first 2 or 3 years, there was 100 full-time equivalents of U.S. faculty in Rwanda across those four cadres. And now we went to 80, and now we're about 60, and then 40 and 20 is the years peter out, while as the number of new Rwandan faculty grows. So this next year will be the first bolus of residents who have graduated, who are trained under this reinforced, strengthened residency program with the U.S. faculty alongside the Rwandan faculty. It's too early to say here are the patient outcomes or the societal outcomes in terms of decreased perioperative mortality or, you know, these actually important but still a bit far off indicators. And what I can tell you is this year we're graduating, well, this year hopefully we're graduating, they all pass, 10 new surgical residents. In the year HRH started, there were 2 surgical residents who graduated, and the next year there were 3, and the next year there were 5. This year, 10 general surgery residents. That was actually a class that was originally 19 residents, and 6 have gone to ortho, 1 to urology, 2 into neurosurgery. So there's a big bolus of new young specialists who will still need encouragement, mentoring, support, etc. But I'm hopeful that 5-10 years down the line, all those young men and women will be leading much of what is healthcare delivery in Rwanda.
Just out of curiosity, I was wondering, do you abbreviate the surgical training program? And then is there work hours? And
we're in discussion of lengthening it. So the surgery program was 4 years. And there's been discussions to stretch out to 5 years. Some countries in Africa have a 3-year program, but then everybody with sort of, that's sort of an entry level, you do these sort of basic essential surgery, and then then people will seek other fellowship like trainings. Rwanda is sort of a hybrid in between, and there's discussion of extending it out to 5 years to make it aligned with COSEXA, which is the College of Surgeons of East Central and Southern Africa, to sit for the fellowship exams. For COSEXA, you need to have 5 years of surgical training, so that would just align it with the, kind of the region. One of the region standards, but that's hasn't happened yet. So my saying so doesn't mean it will. Work hours? No, there's no discussion about work hours. In the end, it's a very different context. So people are dependent to get the hospital on public transportation. The public transportation doesn't happen at nighttime, and so. I think the earliest residents ever get in is 6 o'clock in the morning anyhow. It's real hard to, various constraints that don't exist in our setting here. Not a lot of surgery happens at nighttime because there's only 2 anesthetists in for the whole hospital. Various constraints that keep it from having a system that's robust enough in which a resident theoretically could work 100 or 120 hours. So I'm not sure there's a need to, depending on where you land on that debate, not sure there's a need or an opportunity to restrict work hours at the moment.
Could select one either surgical skill or personality trait that you've seen in your residence in Rwanda that you wish more of the U.S. trained residents had. What would you say that is?
Oh, that is an excellent question. I'm going to say this and hope that my U.S. residents don't throttle me when they hear this podcast. But the residents in Rwanda really read. I am often impressed in morning reports. The depth of their textbook knowledge, often on topics that either they've never seen because either the epidemiology is not there or the systems to deal with complex vascular disease. They've never seen it, but they've read about it. And I'm very impressed by that. And so, and I say this as a mirror to myself, because I am constantly challenged as a resident and now as faculty to keep myself up to date and reading, but I'm very impressed with their commitment to read in a place where you don't find books. So everybody's got a laptop and everybody's downloaded all the great textbooks.
That's excellent. We'll switch gears a little bit, and this is something that I kind of noticed on your bio, actually, on the Brigham and Women's website. And you mentioned that, well, they mentioned that you did some surgical device innovation during your tours in sub-Saharan Africa. Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, this was, I'll be honest, it's something I kind of stumbled into from a identified need, which was the identified need is a need for better wound care. So many hospitals in Africa, or in research limited settings, it's true in Haiti too. I can't speak for every country in the world because I haven't been there, but across the African settings I've been in, the Caribbean settings I've been in, one common feature is that many, many surgical beds are taken up by people who are there for chronic wound care. And the chronic wound, I sort of see as the final common pathway of many different conditions that often require a surgeon's attention. That could be just a wound from trauma, or it could be osteomyelitis, that spontaneous osteomyelitis that we don't have here, but separative osteomyelitis is all over Africa and turns into this giant wound. It could be a surgical site infection. It could be abscess. It could be burns. It could be cancers that are fungating. And decubitus ulcers because of paraplegia for trauma or cancer or whatever, and those folks stay in those beds forever, or at least weeks and weeks and weeks. And that's one of the many different bottlenecks for throughput of other surgical deliveries. If you don't have any beds, then you don't operate on patients, and then those patients either don't get their hernias electively fixed and they show up with strangulated hernias, or they don't get their cancers taken care of, etc. So the first time I ever went to Rwanda, I was in a rural district hospital that was supported by the NGO Partners in Health. And a friend, or man who's become a friend of mine, is an ID guy, asked me to round the surgical ward because, as he said, for him it was like rounding in the sixth circle of hell. And it was basically a wound ward. It's like, gosh, if we could figure out some way to get some negative pressure on these wounds and get them either ready for skin grafting sooner or just closed faster or at least out of the hospital to a clinic base or home based, wouldn't that be great? But electricity is erratic. There's only two suction machines in the hospital, so you can't even sort of jury-rig a non-KCI negative pressure wound therapy device. And so I was back in Boston, and we had a Global Surgery Journal club. And just chit-chatting, and a plastic surgeon in the group had said, she was doing her Master of Public Health, and she'd heard about this MIT engineer who had been working on a non-electric wound vac. And I tracked her down. Turns out that engineer was now a PhD candidate, but she had done part of that work as her master's project, and her name is Danielle Zarochek. And Danielle, working with another surgeon from the Harvard system, one of the burn surgeons over at Mass General and the Shriner, had developed a pump-based negative pressure device was just mechanical pressure. And estimated the cost of it would be $5. And you know, it was non-electric, it was reusable or recyclable, and had all these sort of great things. And it was made from blow molded plastic that we had one blow molding factory in America, but there are three of them in the little country Rwanda, and there's about a million of them in China. They make your Coke bottles, et cetera. And this just seemed like a great fit. And so we got our approvals, et cetera, and first trialed on a patient in Rwanda. And it, you know, all we really could say is that we got it to stick to the patient. And then the Haiti earthquake happened. And folks who were there as immediate responders wrote back saying, you know, that device you've been working on would be really useful here because there's a lot of wounds for all the survivors. And in the post-earthquake fervor, you know, people were donating things left and right, and all of a sudden I had 400 toilet plungers, which is essentially the suction device, in my attic now from China. We got some good advice saying, are you really going to take 400 toilet plungers to Haiti post-earthquake? So we didn't do that. But we had a team that was working on wound care, and we brought as much as we could take in suitcases so that we wouldn't be leaving stuff behind if it was useless. And found that at least patients were happier because they were more likely to get wound care and less likely to have pain because the wounds were covered, et cetera. You know, again, that's not an outcome measure. But that was a start. And so then we regrouped and worked with an engineer and back in Rwanda, went through sort of a series of device iterations. And so went through about 8 iterations of the device to get the seal perfect. Because that's really where the money was, or that's really where the challenge was. Your standard adhesive plastic dressing makes wrinkles, and if you have continuous negative pressure, i.e. with an electric machine, you can overcome that. But if you only have 300 cc's of space in your pump, then you have to have a perfect seal. Anyhow, so we went through several iterations of that, and enough sort of patient testing, again, under all the appropriate approvals, both Rwanda and the U.S., until we found a prototype that seemed to, it was working. And now that's gone kind of offline for a while as Danielle Zrochek, the engineer and now the CEO of the sort of company starting it, has gotten it through all the various stages of manufacturing so that it can still be highly affordable, yet not be based merely as a nonprofit. So the company can be self-sustaining for the next device innovation for this kind of setting. So that device, the wound pump, is being tested in a few places. Not currently in Rwanda, mostly because we didn't have the bandwidth to do it right now. But they're trialed a bit in Uganda. They were looking to trial it Congo Brazzaville, if I remember correctly. So I am hoping that said device is soon ready to be widely distributed because I think it'll either A, decrease the number of patients in beds, or A, decrease the number of patients in beds because A, wounds are healed faster, and or because wound care is simplified and patients can be moved further down the referral ladder. So out of district hospitals into health centers or into sort of wound care villages, opening up beds for more surgical care. That was a very long story. I apologize.
No, it's very, very fascinating. And two questions here to close it out. One, is there a way we could show a picture of that either on a wound or by itself to post on our website? I'm just curious, and I'm sure some other listeners out there would be curious what it looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. I can send it to you afterwards.
Perfect. And then the last question before we dive into our final five is, all of the listeners out here presumably are interested in global health and possibly contributing themselves. You know, most of us aren't going to be able to join a university faculty as global health staff. How would you recommend the everyday surgeon getting involved? Is it good enough to go, you know, volunteer on a mercy ship? Should we just give financial donations? Or should we try and get into a program that's actually training other surgeons, or is there a mix?
Yeah, I mean, when we say global surgery, I think we often think of over there surgery, international surgery, but you know, global really means the globe. And it's often is referring to global health. It's really referring to equity and creating opportunities for health and health care for people who don't have it, right? The poor. So Dorchester, which is 3 miles from my house, is on the globe as well and also has severe resource limitations. So there's opportunities to start to deal with some of the inequities in our own settings. That's one. But assuming that most people are thinking about other countries and other contexts and other languages, et cetera, you know, for a while I was pretty dour about two-week drop-in missions, do a bunch of hernias or whatever. And I still am, I think those can have benefit if organized well. I think they also can do a lot of damage to local economies, much like food aid made in Ethiopia made famine worse because it undercut the farmers' markets, and so farmers stopped working, and so now there's no food being produced in Ethiopia. So if people come and do a whole bunch of free surgery, and then surgeons, local surgeons, can't actually make a living, then the local surgeons stop working locally, and now you have a lot less surgical care delivery. So think as Northerners and North Americans who have some time to help and would like to help with the skills they have as surgical providers, I think it can be done well. But I think the way to do that well is to have your efforts integrate into a larger framework, either with a known organization that is integrated well into the settings, whether that's on the humanitarian side, i.e. Doctors Without Borders, et cetera, who as an organization make sure that you are working appropriately, or through organizations that are focused on teaching. And I'm obviously on the educational side of things, and so that's my bias. But in Rwanda this last year, we've had a hand surgery team who could have come and demanded this, and the other, but rather they worked with the local plastic surgeon who had set up, you know, these are the things I really want to A, learn for myself, B, have my residents learn. These are the complex patients we need help with. And they had a beautifully organized and integrated effort from which everybody came, left happy, and I think all sides benefited. So I think the recommendation I'd make is take the effort to look for opportunities where you are investing into the local setting beyond the delivery of those dozen operations, whether that's in teaching and training, supporting local doc surgeons, et cetera. And then probably the single most important characteristic one can have in any of this is humility. Because for sure, things are much more complicated than you think. And there are reasons for why people have done X, Y, or Z is almost certainly not what you think it is.
Oh, that was fantastic. Thank you.
Well, that takes us into our final five segment. And this is where we ask you five questions to let listeners get a better idea where you're coming from and kind of maybe some of your interests. The first question we have for you is that when you're in the operating room,
what's in Rwanda?
Oh, in Rwanda, I guess, too. Yeah. What's on your iPod or is there any music playing in the operating room?
That's a great question. So I'll admit I am no musical expert. That's probably not the right word, but essentially the music that's played in my operating room is whatever the resident I'm operating with wants, as long as their interests don't inhibit what I think was the non-technical skills of surgery, i.e. communication, decision-making, situational awareness. So for me, headbanging metal, most rap, inhibits my ability to do those things. The music turns off at critical moments. If I'm stuck to my own devices, then it's usually pretty laid back Latin music, or if it's the holidays, it's Handel's Messiah.
All right, great. And what hobbies, talents, and interests do you have outside of the operating room? and particularly at least one hobby or talent that you do abroad?
So running is my mainstay of sanity. I've since the Boston Marathon bombing that we had here a few years ago, I've now gotten into this habit of running the Boston Marathon with the Brigham team, and that's been great fun, and it's become a bit of a family tradition. Our favorite uncle is a many time Boston Marathoner, so getting to train for the Boston Marathon at altitude in the hills of Rwanda is particularly fun for me, and especially if it means I'm not training in Boston winters and then can come here in April and run it. Beyond that, I think any opportunity I can get, which are not as many, but maybe they're more so than before, to be out of doors. We just took our boys to Western Mass and introduced them to kayaking, trail running, hiking, and biking in a 3-day period, and got a lot of fresh air.
Oh, great. Question number 3. I know you do a lot of traveling, but is there a favorite trip or vacation that you've taken, maybe for leisure this time?
Perhaps our favorite vacation was when my wife and I, we were still both trainees here in Boston. I was a fellow, she was a resident. And we went to Acadia National Park in Bar Harbor, Maine. We camped. We cooked over the fire. We hiked and swam and did all these outdoor things. And I think for 5 days, our vacation cost us $300. It was completely life-giving. So Acadia National Park, it's one of my favorite places on the planet.
If you had not gone into medicine, number 4, what would you be doing?
Not gone into medicine. There were two things on the table before medicine. They all might sound pretty unrelated. So one was I was going to train in linguistics and be a Bible translator in remote places where this hadn't been translated yet, Irian Jaya or Papua New Guinea. So that really would have been living in the sticks. The other one would have been a high school biology teacher. So, up to that point in my life, one of the most important people in my life, besides my parents, was my high school bio teacher, and I love the life sciences, and I loved teaching.
All right, question for number 5, and our final question, and also probably the most commonly asked question on our show. If you go back in time and see yourself on the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
I give myself the same advice that somebody tried to give me in my first month. Dr. Pinson, one of our hepatobiliary surgeons at Vanderbilt, which was every day, read 15 minutes, do that every day of the year, and it's amazing how much you'll learn in 5 years. I wish I would have listened to Pinson, but I do say it a lot to people who will listen.
Well, I'm listening, and I'm going to try and incorporate that, so thank you. And Dr. Ravello, we really appreciate you coming on the show. It's fascinating learning about your experiences abroad, and you're an inspiration to the rest of us. So thank you for what you do.
Guys, thank you for the time to talk, and thank you for the podcast you put together. I became aware of Behind the Knife just a couple months ago, and think what you're doing for the community of residents and students is fantastic. So thanks for the privilege.
That's excellent to hear. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's episode of Behind the Knife. Special thanks to Dr. Riviello for sharing with us his insights into the world of global surgery. And for now, at least, that concludes our global surgery series. So join us next week on another episode of Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast.
Until next time, dominate the day.